So this has been a really tough week for me. I think it's been tough for a lot of people here. There are a lot of, as we talked about earlier, anger, agitation, grief. And this week I've really noticed in myself that my heart has not been open at all. It's been really tight. And I had a different topic that I was going to talk about tonight and decided that it might be more appropriate, maybe not, to talk about states of open heart and of closed heart and how to cultivate these. And I think this is a good time for us to at least have a reminder. Much of this material is going to be review, but I'm a big fan of review. So you might have guessed by now that I'm going to be talking about the Brahma Viharas. And I know you've probably heard lots of talks about the Brahma Viharas, and hopefully I can bring out some new things, or at least remind you of some worthwhile things that you've heard before. So for those of you who haven't heard of them before, Brahma Vihara is a very direct translation from Pali, the language of the earliest teachings of the Buddha that were written down that we have. Brahma is God or of the gods. Brahma was a particular god. He was sort of like the big cheese amongst gods in the Buddha's time. Vihara is dwelling. Simple enough. So when we talk about Brahma Viharas, we're talking about heavenly abodes. So it's sort of like having deities as your roommates. And these are sublime or divine states of mind. And they are said to be natural states of the enlightened mind. I've heard it taught that the Buddha knew only these states of mind, and I'll list them soon. But interestingly, these states of mind can also be cultivated. They can be known by any of us. And they probably already are, to some extent. So there are four of them. The first is called metta, which is usually translated to loving kindness. The second one is karuna, or compassion. The third one is mudita, or sympathetic joy. A little more about what that might mean in a little while. And the fourth one is upekkha, equanimity. So one thing that I find really helpful for explaining or understanding what these are is a teaching that's called the near and the far enemies. And the Buddha didn't actually teach near and far enemies. It comes later in the commentarial tradition. The earliest mention that I know of is in the Visuddhimagga, which comes from, I think, the 5th century AD. So it's quite a bit later, but it's still, I think, enormously helpful. The near and the far enemies. That is, each of these states has something that's really obviously the opposite of the quality. And then there's something else that is a lot like the quality, but there's something a little corrupt about it. So I'll go through them and it may become clearer. Like for metta, loving kindness, the far enemy is anger or ill will. Okay, so that's pretty obvious. Loving kindness, where you're well-wishing for people versus just, the hell with you, ill will. It's the opposite. So that's the far enemy. But the near enemy is usually translated as selfish affection. By the way, I tried to look up the Pali terms and just could not find them online. Selfish affection. And so some commentators say that this is like lust or codependence. And there are loving kindness that has a selfish cast to it. That's not really genuinely well-wishing for the other person, but is sort of like a part of some kind of implicit or explicit bargaining, mental bargaining. Karuna, or compassion, the far enemy is cruelty. All right, that's pretty straightforward. The near enemy is usually translated as pity. And I like that. And this is one of those dangers of translation, is that whatever the Pali words are, pity and compassion are English words, and they have English connotations. And for me, pity has a connotation of being separate, of being superior. There's an aversion implied. There's some condescension implied. I'm really relieved that that's not me. Well, that's really, or as Mr. T would say, I pity the fool. There's something distancing about pity. Whereas compassion is often described as a quiver of the heart for when we see the suffering of someone else, the natural quivering of the heart. And I like that partly because all of these can be, and I think it's helpful to know these in the body rather than just think of them as emotions that take place purely in the coconut. Like any other emotion, they can be known in the body. Mudita, sympathetic joy. This is happiness for others. Happiness at the good fortune of other people. Happiness on other people's behalf. So the far enemy is resentment or envy. You know, somebody has something good happen to them and you're envious. Or you resent that why did it happen to me? I deserve it more than they did. The near enemy is usually translated as frivolous delight or exuberance. And I don't know what the hell that means. But what I find is helpful for me is to think about it as a vicarious enjoyment. That is, you start thinking, oh, wow, that would feel great. If that happened to me, I know I'd really enjoy that. What would it be like to win the lottery? What would it be like to have that nice thing happen to me? You know, wow, I could, you know, it's sort of like all of a sudden it's about you instead of the person who is enjoying that good fortune. And then upekkha, equanimity. And this is a really difficult Ramabhara. Philip Moffat has given whole talks on equanimity. It's a difficult topic. This is not the same as serenity or calm. In fact, all kinds of stuff can be going on, and yet there's still equanimity. Even in the midst of chaos, equanimity implies a clarity and a balance. I know that Oren Sofer likes the word equipoise. The far enemy of upekkha is craving or clinging. Because obviously you don't have equanimity when you're craving or when you're wrapped up, when you're caught up in something. Okay, so you should keep your distance and not get wrapped up in it. That sounds reasonable. But the near enemy is indifference or apathy. So this is something that's often hard for people to understand, is that equanimity is not about apathy. It's not about passivity. It's about retaining one's balance. And I'm going to touch on that more. But just to go back a little bit, what's common, I think, about all the near enemies is that there's always selfing involved. There's always some kind of selfishness or self-reference about it. It's not pure. It's not just purely on behalf of another person. And I think that it's helpful also to be mindful that unless you're enlightened, I'm not enlightened. I don't know anybody who's enlightened. If anybody here is enlightened, I'd like to talk to you afterwards. Unless you're enlightened, your Brahmaviharas are always mixed. I don't think that anybody ever experiences one of these mind states purely without some kind of selfing, without some kind of selfishness. Doesn't have to be a lot, but I think there's always an element of self. And I think that you can learn a lot by observing this. When you're having one of these, just notice what's going on. You might notice it in the body. You might notice it in sort of proliferating thoughts, you know, where you're wandering through this. But I think this is a really good way to learn about how our mind works. And this is not easy, being mindful of Brahma Viharas. I mean, look at it. Loving kindness, compassion, joy on behalf of others' happiness, and equanimity. When you're in them, these are actually very pleasant states. I mean, it's easy to forget that because in compassion, there's also the suffering of others. So, you know, there's the heart's quiver. But when you're in compassion, you're alive. And you're emotionally alive. And there's something very positive and beautiful about that. So it's very hard to be mindful of these states when you're in them, especially when the emotion or when the mind state is very strong. We don't train ourselves to be mindful of beautiful states. We tend to train ourselves to be mindful of unpleasant states because there's this long time teaching of we use mindfulness to fix bad things, right? Sort of like, oh, I've got a headache. Oh, I'll just be mindful of the experience exactly as it is, and I won't do all that worrying and fretting and the second arrow stuff. I'll avoid that, and I'll just use mindfulness to fix a problem. So we're very aware of how helpful it is to be mindful of bad things. But then we forget that mindfulness is something that we should cultivate for the way we live our lives, not something that we use like aspirin and medicine chest for when things are going wrong. So that's a little side rant there. But for an example, and this is an example of sympathetic joy. Sympathetic joy is a tricky one. About 12 or 13 years ago, a good friend of ours won a Pulitzer Prize for some very brilliant work he did that he seriously risked death to accomplish this work. So it was a remarkable thing that he had done, a remarkable project. And when I got the news that he'd won the Pulitzer, my first thing was just this tremendous joy. And it was, oh, wow, that's so great, because he deserved it so much. And then my next thing was, it's so cool that I know a guy who won the Pulitzer Prize. Isn't that great? I know a guy. I mean, hey, I'm with, you know, it's like, it just kicked in without me even noticing it. And certainly not wanting it to be unselfish. I wanted to be unselfish about it. But I learned a lot about myself. Every time, it's great to have joy on behalf of other people, but it's also really helpful to notice that you're always going to stick a little bit of yourself in there. Here's another way of thinking about the Brahma Viharas. They're all related in that metta, loving-kindness, is a fundamental predisposition of mind. It's sort of like a default setting, something you can cultivate, and it's there. And karuna, compassion, is loving-kindness, metta, when it encounters somebody who's having a bad time, when it encounters suffering in other people. Mudita, sympathetic joy, is metta when it encounters somebody having a good time. So it's sort of like, this is loving-kindness when the rubber hits the road. This is loving-kindness when it encounters happiness or sadness. And upekkha, equanimity, is the quality that sustains a balance, which keeps us from getting lost. Upekkha, I used equanimity and equipoise earlier. I also really like equilibrium because it doesn't imply quietude or stillness or apathy or passivity. An athlete in the middle of, a gymnast, say, in the middle of a routine has tremendous equipoise and equilibrium, but is not apathetic and is not passive. So note again the near enemy of equanimity. It's not indifference. Equanimity is not indifference, and it's not calm. A story that I've told before, some years ago, we were driving up in the Sierras, and the brakes of my really ancient VW bug gave out. This is a VW bug that's been the butt of many jokes. It was in a fire, so it had bubbled paint all over it, and I had a piece of red plastic taped over where one of the taillights had melted. And it was really beat, and the horn and the wheel had given out, so I wired it to a button in the dashboard, and when I pushed the horn button, the lights would go out at night. It's a 6-volt battery, right? You cannot run a car on a 6-volt battery. Anyway, the brakes gave out, and I was fortunate enough that there was a fairly wide shoulder. I was going about 60, but for some reason, I kept my head, I did all the right things, even though I was not passive, I was certainly not quiet. All kinds of stuff was going on in my head, but I did all the right things, you know, used the emergency brake, steered carefully, turned off the, you know, and we rolled to a stop. People ran up and said, "Are you guys okay?" And, you know, we were both in a cold sweat, but I realized later on that there had been equanimity through this whole thing. My mind kept in balance, and I'm still alive to testify about it. So that gives you a sense of what equanimity can be like, what the felt sense of equanimity can be like. And if equilibrium is a better word, that's a good word for it as well. But the thing about equilibrium or equanimity is it's easy in some of the other Brahma Viharas to become overwhelmed. I think particularly compassion, when you're really involved in the suffering of others, it's very easy to be overwhelmed, and caretakers know this well. It's very hard to take care of yourself if you're a caretaker or if you're involved in dealing with suffering in the world. Equanimity is what can help keep the balance, keep you from becoming overwhelmed. So it's important, I think, particularly now, after this week, to look to equanimity to sustain us and keep us from despair and apathy. Because despair and apathy are deadly in this kind of situation. So the thing about the Brahma Viharas, I've talked about what the states are like. And there are practices to cultivate all four of them. And we've talked a lot in Sangha about Samatha, concentration practice, and Vipassana, insight practices, and how they combine to produce mindfulness, to support mindfulness. And they're important practices that can be thought of as separate practices or can be thought of as the same practice. The Buddha didn't talk about them as being separate practices, although he often described meditation in different ways as if they were different practices. So concentration is what unifies and steadies the mind. And Vipassana, insight, is what gives us the discernment of mind. And you need them both. You need the power, you need the edge. But Brahma Vihara practices, particularly metta, helps balance these, helps bring them into the heart. Because people often find mindfulness practice to be dry. Dry is the adjective used so often. Now, it's when mindfulness practice is really strong, it's not at all dry. It's really felt in the heart. But when you're just going through the practice itself, it can feel very dry. And metta practice in particular helps balance that by working to open the heart. And there are exercises, as I said, for cultivating all four of these states. But metta is really the starting point because it underlies the other three states. Metta is a concentration practice. Usually it's taught as a mixture of visualization and chant. So here's a quote from Gil Fronsdale. "The practices of mindfulness and loving kindness support one another. Metta practice complements mindfulness by encouraging an attitude of friendliness towards our experience, regardless of how difficult it may be." Mindfulness complements loving kindness by guarding it from becoming partial or sentimental. Mindfulness can bring freedom. Loving kindness ensures that our path to freedom is not aloof from others. I'm going to read this again. I like this so much. The practices of mindfulness and loving kindness support one another. Metta practice complements mindfulness by encouraging an attitude of friendliness toward our experience, regardless of how difficult it may be. Mindfulness complements loving kindness by guarding it from becoming partial or sentimental. Mindfulness can bring freedom. Loving kindness ensures that our path to freedom is not aloof from others. I really like his word, use of the word friendliness. I know that I think it's Donald Rothbard likes to use the word radiant friendliness for metta instead of loving kindness. And I love that because for me, in the body, metta, when it's strong, feels radiant. It's a physical sensation of radiance. It's not a mood. It's not an idea. There's a physical radiance about it. So the practice, the metta practice, and most of you have done metta practice and done metta retreats, but the idea is to direct well-wishing towards someone. And it's traditionally taught this way, although it turns out the Buddha did not teach it this way. The Buddha's instructions on metta practice that we have today are really quite simple. And I'm not going to go into detail, but it's simply radiating goodwill and then radiating it in multiple directions. And some practitioners choose to do it that way. The Venerable Anālayo does it that way because he likes to stay very close to what's in the suttas rather than what comes later. Me, I find that there's a lot of great stuff that came later, so I'm willing to pick and choose. So the way it's usually taught is to calm and settle the mind, sometimes stay with the breath for a while to just sort of settle down, and then choose a recipient for your well-wishing. A benefactor, say, that this is usually the traditional start. Someone for whom you have gratitude, and I like this a lot, the very thought of this person makes you smile. So maybe a grandparent, or a teacher, or a pet, or the Dalai Lama. And then you visualize the recipient holding that person in your heart, and then you direct loving kindness towards that person. And then there's various chants that people do. One chant that some people really like to use is the one that we often end our evenings here with. That's a chant that was developed by a group of prisoners in San Quentin that Philip Moffat was working with. And he's used that chant over the years as an honor to them. Philip really likes that. I find that a little wordy myself. But there are many chants, and they're usually along the lines of wishing someone safety, happiness, good health and vitality, and then the fourth one is usually at ease or in well-being or knowing peace. And then you would visualize the recipient enjoying these qualities. And as the metta deepens through the practice, the words might fall away entirely. And then the traditional teaching is that you progress through a list of recipients. When it starts easy, and then it gets tough. So traditionally, you start with the self. And it's felt that this is generally tough for Westerners, because Westerners tend to be more down on themselves. It's said that somebody once asked the Dalai Lama, one of his early trips to the U.S. to meet Western practitioners, somebody asked him, "What about self-loathing?" Dalai Lama was completely puzzled. He turned to his translator, and he had a long conversation with the translator. And I don't remember even what his answer was, but it was just a novel concept to him. So this one is a tough one, but the Buddha said, "No one deserves happiness more than you." So the Buddha gives you permission to wish well of yourself, gives you permission to wish happiness for yourself, encourages you to wish happiness for yourself. Happiness is one of the proximate causes for concentration. It's a necessity. It's It's something that he expected, and he gave advice both to lay people and to his monks on how to find happiness. And it was a different set of points for the two audiences. For lay people, it was things like have a good family, have good work, have good digestion. You know, pretty obvious things for cultivating happiness. But that after one's, if you're doing this yourself, it might help to visualize yourself as a child. Because you might not be all that happy about yourself now. You might be unwilling to entirely forgive yourself for things you've done in your life. But think of the child that you were. Visualize that child. Surely that child deserves good wishes. And it's perfectly okay to start with a benefactor. So a lot of Western teachers start with a benefactor. But the traditional order is to go with self, benefactor, loved one, friend, neutral person, difficult person, like Dick Cheney, and then go to all beings, radiating well-wishing to everyone in the universe in an expanding circle. And the progression could take place over one sit, or it could take place over a long retreat. If you've gone on a 7-day metta retreat, you'll find that they try to escalate as they move through each day. I'm not very good at this, so I tend to stay with the benefactor through the whole retreat. I take the easy way out. One teacher says that if your heart is opening, the expansion of recipients is completely natural. I was too lazy to find that out. I just stayed with the benefactor. And when you're doing this, it's easy to get stuck in story, which is why the concentration practice helps so much by steadying the mind. And it's always okay to go back to concentration, to go back to samatha. Another obstacle is that sometimes it feels like we're just stuck in some schmaltzy Hallmark greeting card. You know, come on, you know, may you be safe, may you be happy. It just sounds dopey. It's hard to let go of that, especially, you know, we've grown up in a cynical time. Sarcasm comes easily to us. I think it's important to really experiment with metta practice. Years ago, Philip Moffat told me that I should do metta practice. And I encountered it a couple times in retreat, you know, the standard formula that I just laid out to you, and it did not resonate with me at all. So when Philip told me that, it was like, oh, come on. Oh, please. And I didn't. I ignored it. And then finally, I went on a metta retreat, and I experimented. And I think this is really important. I've talked a lot about how important curiosity is in the spiritual path. So I tried different things, and I found that the whole visualization thing really didn't work for me along with the chant, because I started running home movies of the person, you know, because these were people I knew. So it's sort of like I started remember the time we went hiking in Tilden Park, and remember, oh yeah, and it was raining the day that I, you know, we went to get carpooled to the retreat. So it's very easy for me to get stuck in home movies. So it's important to experiment, find out what works. Philip really likes the chant that he brought back from San Quentin. Other people like much simpler chants. Some people don't chant at all, but stick with the visualization. They find that much more resonant. Something that I have found helpful is that when there is metta, there is a direct physical sense of joy in the body. It may be very subtle at first. It might be quite strong. It may grow stronger later on. And a metta retreat is a great way to experiment with what works for you and what doesn't. The thing is, it's really easy to teach concentration practice. You sit down, you follow the breath. Your mind wanders off, go back to the breath, rinse and repeat. It's very easy to explain it. Hard to do, but it's easy to explain it. Metta is much harder because everybody's different. What works for one person doesn't work for everybody else. But for me, and for a number of people I know, knowing that metta is known in the body can be really helpful. I find, and other people have too, that sometimes if there's no metta available to you as any kind of felt physical sensation, that if it's just all in the coconut, sometimes you can kickstart it with gratitude. I find some gratitude practice, and I sometimes throw this into a guided sit. Just be happy for life. Happy to have known love. Happy for the breath. There's so much to be grateful for, even in tough times like this, that knowing gratitude in the body can translate very easy to turning around and that sensation radiating it out towards some recipient. Usually I would choose somebody who, the thought of whom would make me smile. And then what can happen is piti and sukha arise. Piti is usually translated as joy or rapture. Sukha as happiness. These are jhana factors. Factors that lead to and are part of deep absorption states. So piti and sukha can be known in metta practice. When I first heard, I was told years ago that at IMS, if somebody wanted to do jhana practice, somebody really wanted to try to move into the deep absorption states, they would teach metta practice. And when I first heard that, I thought it was hilarious. Because for me, it was so... This was back when metta practice got me nowhere. It just got me into home movies and just, I didn't like it at all. But it really made a lot more sense to me later when I saw how it could start to create like a feedback loop. That when you have some kind of joy in the body and you direct it to somebody else, somehow it amplifies. And it becomes like a feedback loop that can grow. So again, be curious about what works for you in metta. And a metta retreat is a great way, because you've got all this time. What else are you going to do? So it's a great place to experiment for what works for you for metta. And I really, really recommend it. It's a very powerful practice. So one thing that's said, and I think is helpful, that when you are sitting, and sometimes I've done metta sits, and the gratitude, it's just not there. Loving kindness, just not there. But I try to work with it anyway, because we're trying to cultivate loving kindness, and if it was just natural to us, if it just came easily, we wouldn't need metta practice. We'd already be there, just for free. But we're cultivating it. We're working at it. It's not always easy. Although I think it's important to stay relaxed about it. We don't struggle to get metta. We don't fight to get metta. That just adds conflict. I like to use the example of the brain scan of the violinist's brain, which shows that the fingers of her left hand, the part of the brain that controls the fingers of the left hand, is much bigger, more well-developed, many more neurons than in ordinary people. She wasn't born that way. It's not genetic. She didn't just luck out and get violin-playing genes. That part of the brain was developed over years of practice and years of playing. And this is what we now call, this has been the buzzword for the last 5 or 10 years, neuroplasticity. Neuroplasticity is your friend. Because you can develop these qualities. You can develop more loving kindness, more capacity for loving kindness, more capability for loving kindness, more ease with loving kindness. so easy to reinforce pathways in our mind, negative as well as positive, like anger. We create these neural patterns, we reinforce them. And anger reduces cognition, so developing one's anger makes you stupid. Seriously, they've done cognition tests. When you're angry, you have impaired cognition. And I know people who cultivate their own anger, who are reinforcing their own anger. They must be able to play a really angry violin, or the violin of anger. They've gotten really good at it, and everything around them makes them angry. It's interesting to watch them, that person, one person I'm thinking of in particular, watching him react to stuff that most people would find neutral, he gets angry about. We can choose to repattern positively. We can choose to repattern and gain more capacity for loving kindness, for compassion. When you develop the loving kindness, the compassion and the sympathetic joy just come naturally, because that underlies the other two. So we're physically changing our brains while we're reprogramming our minds when we do these practices. And there are traditional practices to cultivate karuna, mudita, and upekkha, but I think that the metta really underlies them and itself first must be strong. So going back to the balance of the heart practices, or the Brahmaviharas and the wisdom practices, the combination of concentration and mindfulness practice. This is also stated sometimes as a balance of wisdom and compassion. So this is my opportunity to repeat a great quote from Nisargadatta Maharaj, who says, "Wisdom tells me I am nothing. Love tells me I am everything. Between the two, my life flows." So that's all I got. It'll have to do. But we do have time then for questions, for discussion, rants, raves. And there's a microphone here.
I haven't really done that much metta, and I've been curious how it's used as a samatha practice. I don't really quite understand how that works.
Well, in just about any form you do, in mindfulness practice, by comparison, mindfulness practice is just noticing phenomena, and rather than staying with something like the breath or some particular object. And there are different ways that that's taught. But in metta practice, what you do is you're staying with a combination of things, which makes it tricky. But the combination of things involves some kind of balance between visualization, which is a concentration practice, the chant, which is like mantra practice, which is also a concentration practice, and physical sensation, you know, well-wishing, which is also a concentration practice. So, unfortunately, doing all three of them at the same time, for me anyway, is not a concentration practice. It's just get lost in home movies practice. But for many people, it resonates just that way. For other people, finding some aspect. For me, that physical sense of radiating goodwill is just completely engages my attention. So I'm not... For me, that's a concentration practice. So it's taught as a concentration practice, and I think it works well as one. So that's why, I laughed at the idea that it could be used to get the jhana. But It definitely can. You've got... Pass it to Patty.
Thank you. That was a very much needed and beautiful talk.
Thank you.
You mentioned that there's always a bit of self when we're trying to do meta practice. I find, and that really resonated with me, because I use meta practice to calm myself. And I'm seeing there's a benefit for me even before I go in. When I'm totally riled up, the first thing I go to is breathe, and may I find peace, ease, may I find peace, may I find ease. I send meta to myself to calm myself, and that sort of builds in selfishness. It's like I'm doing meta toward myself, but I use it as a way of calming my mind and calming my heart. And this week, it was like I was compulsively sending meta to everyone who's suffering from the same thing I'm suffering from, which is, you know, the shock and the fear and the dread. But I use meta, and so there's a lot of self in the motivation for it, and I find it really works to calm me.
Yes.
So there's a conflict there for me, because it's supposed to be when compassion meets suffering. When compassion meets suffering, I'm sending karuna. But I'm doing it for selfish reasons.
And I think you don't want to get judgmental on yourself for that. It's great to have compassion for yourself. And it's okay to notice that it's not entirely unselfish. That none of us are enlightened here. And I don't think anybody short of full enlightenment is going to be able to do it without some little bit of selfing. And that's fine. At a time like this, we also need self-soothing. Whiskey works, but meta works better. Meta is better. There's a slogan for you. But thank you for that.
So you spoke about anger and ill will, and to be used to overcome that. I think for me, when I noticed this week with others in response to the election, and in myself as well, there's anger, but there's also a lot of fear. What would the Buddha say about overcoming fear? Because for me, when I thought about the fear, then my mind went to, okay, well, let's go to, maybe it doesn't matter. Maybe, you know, but that's like a trick of the mind that's not really true, because it really does matter, and the outcomes and the fallout matters to a lot of people. So that didn't really work. So I wonder if you could speak to that, because to me, fear is actually lower vibration than anger. It's really the base. And so when people go that low, it's really hard to get out, even to get up to anger sometimes. Mm-hmm. They feel, you know, despair, they feel hopelessness about a situation. And so I'm just wondering what the Buddha would say about fear and how to get out of that state of fear.
I'm not sure what the Buddha would say, because actually fear is something that doesn't show up in Buddhist psychology, interestingly enough. I think, and different teachers say different things about it. Some treat it as a form of aversion. Some people think of it as a physical response rather than an emotional response. So, but that's not helpful, is it? My own feeling is that metta is a great thing to try, and sometimes metta just isn't enough, especially when there's fear. You know, you may have noticed this. You know, I've tried to do metta this week and found that I was just too agitated. And for that, all I could do was sort of to observe the agitation and try to also notice, and I alluded to this a little in the guided sit, that while I knew that there was fear, that which knew the fear was not itself afraid. It's like being aware that there is fear, that there is anger, that there is agitation, and yet the awareness itself is not frightened or agitated or angry. And that can bring kind of a stillness, a steadiness. You don't try to make the fear go away, because it won't. You just allow that fear to happen inside of a larger space. in which there is also room for stillness. That's the best I could do. It wasn't pleasant, but at least I didn't lose it completely. Margaret had a hand up.
So my understanding, actually, I never wanted to, I was afraid to do insight or Vipassana practice. So my entry, other than just breathing, watching the breath, was to do metta and several retreats years ago. And my understanding, maybe I'm wrong, but this is what I remember, is that the Buddha actually, that metta wasn't an approach, a technique that was for fearful people. So it really, you know, like the different personality types or different types of people, different, you know, techniques of meditation could be better for. And metta was for fearful people.
It could be. I haven't run into that, but that doesn't mean there's a lot that can be run into that I haven't run into. I know that the Buddha only taught one technique for metta, and it was very simple, but he also talked about metta a lot in other contexts, a lot, and talked about it as being a valuable quality to cultivate. So he may have recommended it for fearful people or for other contexts.
Actually,
it's on. Good. Yeah. So don't let me discourage you from trying metta. I think Deborah has had a hand up for a while. Okay.
Thank you, Deborah.
And I wanted to say one other thing about the issue of selfishness, because Ajahn Sumedho once gave a talk that Philip Moffat talked about here, and he said that this is one of those paradoxes that in some ways we're doing metta practice to become better people. The whole thing about cultivating the part of the mind that has a capacity for this. So there's selfishness almost built into the very wanting to cultivate metta. So in some sense it's inevitable that it'll be there. And so we have to balance that. It's sort of like it absolutely has to be selfless and yet it absolutely can't be. Sorry.
I just want to throw this one thought into the pot because I haven't heard it yet. And it might, you know, be encouraging. But I've gone to a few meta retreats and a couple of them with Guy Armstrong. Mm-hmm. And what he always says is, if you do meta, you will sleep better at night. It's true. Try it.
And I know for many people that is true. We had another hand back here. Oh, Deborah, okay.
So two memories came up for me. Again, a long time ago, I may not be remembering it accurately, I was on a retreat at Green Gulch, and the topic of selfishness or selfing, letting go of ego and all of that, and what was said at that time was, to let go of our ego, we have to have a healthy ego. And as it's been pointed out so many times, you said it tonight, I've heard so many teachers say it, we're really rough on ourselves in the Western world. And I think self-metta-ing is a healthy practice, and that's a personal take on it. It's a good thing, not a selfish thing. And Philip once told me a phrase that I actually forget to use, but I think it's really appropriate today. I feel this fill in the blank, this fear, this anger, this worry. I feel this suffering. May this suffering cease. And this suffering could be, you know, whatever it is.
That is a variant on the compassion practice. That's great practice. No, I'm a big fan of metta practice. Lucia?
Of course, I went into a real tailspin when this whole thing eventually wound itself out. I immediately found myself saying metta for our new president-elect. May he find the wisdom and clarity and kindness. Because throughout the whole campaign, it was definitely not in that track. Okay. And all of a sudden, when I started that phrase, I recognized that that was the method for the difficult person. Before then, when I practiced that for difficult people, it was all very abstract, you know, what difficult person? Okay, so let me just pick somebody out of the air. This was a real, real experience.
This is an advanced practice, not recommended for everybody. How did it go?
Actually, you know something? It really helped me to get a grip on where I stand in the scheme of things right now. I vowed that I would try as much as possible to avoid being angry, you know. And I also said, okay, what can I do concrete here to help myself and help others? And so I picked out several organizations that I typically just donate money to, and I've taken those organizations, and I'm going to make a consistent donation to each one of them, because they are organizations which really work toward human rights, civil rights, and conservation rights. So that's what it did. It helped me to avoid getting embroiled and bound up by that, you know, anger and fear. And I have a lot of anxiety about what's going to happen over the next several years. That is, it doesn't go away, but at least I can get a handle on it.
Yeah. It also sounds like your metta practice helped cultivate some equanimity.
Well, I think that may be a little delusion, I'm not sure.
Just a little bit. Come on, admit it.
Of course, I'm not saying it didn't. You know, that's okay, I'm just going to walk away from this kind of thing, you know, that detachment. But the metta, I still practice that now for him, and I'm hoping that, you know, whether he'll get it or not, but it helps.
Great.
Yeah.
So, actually, Barbara was next, and then Shia.
No, I just was speaking to the whole problem of fear, because I found this week part of my agitation was fear. And one way I would deal with fear is, again, is what is true for me now in body, in this moment? Especially right after that, am I ever going to sleep? Right, you know. And I just thought, okay, what's true for me now in the body? And I could see how my mind would create thoughts that would feed the fear. And so, one of the kinds of mindfulness I needed to develop was to be mindful of that activity and try to stay grounded in this moment in the body. And that, at times, helped. Enable me to visit where I could do that.
It's another great practice suggestion. Shia, and I think that's going to be the last one for tonight.
In the midst of all of this that happened this week, somewhere upset and so forth, I it occurred to me, well, you know, well, how is this going to change my life, the fact that Donald Trump is now going to be president? And I came up with that, me personally, it's probably not going to have much of an effect on my life. I'm not in line for an abortion anytime soon, and I'm not going to lose my health insurance. So the upset I came to, the upset that I feel is how it will affect other people's lives more than my own. And that helped me to note a couple of things. One is that somewhere I care for all these other people. If I didn't care for those other people, I wouldn't be upset because it isn't going to personally affect me. And it also helped clarify my values to the extent that, well, yeah, I value that people should have access to medical care and people should have access to be taking care of their body and access that people shouldn't be banned from the country and all these things. I'm not being banned from the country. So that along with some teacher, and I'm really bad on memory, a few weeks ago said, well, if you want to do meta and it's difficult people and you can't do it, well, at least don't start hating it as a starting point for doing meta. If you start hating them, then you've lost the meta. It's impossible to wish anybody well. So anyway, those are my experiences in this week.
Thank you.